a packet in front of them. First order of business, would anyone like to make a comment about the minutes or a motion?
Thank you. I'll make a motion to approve the minutes. Motion by Ms. Barnum to approve the minutes. Do we have a second? Second by Dr. Robinson. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Minutes approved. The only announcement I have right now, we'll have more discussion at the end, is that Speaker Lockhart is ill, and that is why she is not here. And the one time that I said it would be okay to not live stream this is the one time that she's very interested in having it live streamed. So, but she will be listening to the recording, and is very, she has a lot of energy and enthusiasm about our agenda today. She went through that and personally requested many of the items. We all know from the discussion last time that she is very, very interested in issues particularly related to child care and education services, and actually had a visit in Washington, D.C. about a week and a half ago with Senator Mike Lee related to these services, and was not happy with the federal government's role in this, and provided him some very energetic input related to the things that we had discussed last time. And she has committed to continue to do that going forward. So, first item on the agenda, I would like to welcome Lori Schillingworth, Executive Vice President and Director of Business Banking at Zions Bank, to discuss the Women's Leadership Council. Thank you so much for coming here this morning, bright and early.
Thank you.
Welcome.
First off, can you read me at one?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay,
we don't mention it. Okay. I'd like to start off by telling you a little bit about myself and the reason that I am so passionate about women's issues. I started Zions Bank in 1997, where I started the Women's Financial Group, which is still in existence today. And we serve many, many women in wanting to start up their own businesses. They may already have existing businesses, and they just need some help. What I found out during the time, my time at the Women's Financial Group, is there still is a need for it, because women, and I'm quoting women, so I'm not assuming this, feel like when they talk to a male banker, sometimes it feels like they're asking their dad for money. They won't ask the right questions that need to be asked to make sure that they're successful, because they don't want to appear stupid to the male counterpart. So the Women's Financial Group is made up of all women, women commercial loan officers, women and women insurance officer, woman investment officer, everybody that you can need on your team, on both on the business side and the personal side, is a woman counselor or a woman associate. So that was 18 years ago. And I've been involved in many different women's groups. And in my experience, I feel I have found a large gap that I would like to help to decrease that gap. So today, I'm really here for the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce. Right now, I'm the co-chair of the Board of Governors. Next July, I will become the chair of the Board of Governors for the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce. During this time, I wanted to do something that really affected this gap that I have found, and I felt that it's very important in Utah. We've been working on this for probably about 4 months. It's still in its infancy. However, it's moving very quickly now. have a business plan, and we will probably be doing a soft launch in January when the Finesse Film Festival's here, and then another launch later, maybe in March or April, shortly before I take over the chair of the LA Chamber of Commerce. So the name of the group that we presented is the Women's Leadership Institute. It has two very specific missions. One of them is to seek and prepare current and future female leaders to run and win positions in local and federal government. Also to obtain positions in qualifications to become experienced on being able to sit on corporate boards. And also to help promote women into the C-suite positions. As far as the women's leadership gap, women comprise only 14.6% of executive officers, 8.1% of top earners, and 4.6% of Fortune 500 CEOs. In addition, the Center of American Women in Politics reported that women currently hold 100, or 18.7, of the 535 seats in the 133rd U.S. Congress, and 20, or 20% of the 100 seats in the Senate. These statistics highlight a drastic underrepresentation of women in politics, because in the Center of American Progress report, women make up to 50.8% of the population of the United States. So we argue that 51% almost of our population, yet we're very well underrepresented. In the state of Utah, the numbers are not encouraging at all. In fact, I'm going to quote Ann Burkholder, Chief Executive of the YWCA. 16.3% of the 2014 Utah legislature was women, and 5 of those women are leaving this year. So our state is not well represented in the legislature. So the mission of the Women's Leadership Institute is to elevate the stature of female leadership in Utah. This is not, as I talked to Lane Beatty, president of the chamber, and gave him an update of where we were at this point, because we rolled out the idea a few months ago. He said, "Oh, I think this is a very important women's issue that we need to take on." And I replied, "With all due respect, Lane, this is not a women's issue. This is an economic development issue. Because what I see happening is with all of the efforts that we're trying to do to bring companies to Utah through the offices of the governors, or GOVET, we need talented people. And there are a lot of talented leadership women in this country that we need to bring into the state to help make sure that we can get those big companies to relocate to Utah." So I believe it really is an economic issue. The other reason is because with all of the press that I'm sure you've heard lately, one from the USA Today, and then the most frequent one from the New York Post, is not painting a very good picture of Utah in not only the country, but not just in the United States, but around the world. And if that continues, we will not be able to obtain the quality, leadership, and talent of women across the country to come to Utah. I want to tell you just a short story. I'll make sure I leave plenty of time for questions. We have a woman on our executive committee who lived in Florida, was offered a job at IHC as chief operating officer. they flew her out and wine and dined her and told her all of the good reasons that she should be moving to Utah. And she fell in love with it. She went back to Florida, told her family and friends and her husband that they were going to be moving to Utah. And every one of them said, "You've got to be kidding. That is the worst state for women. Why would you want to go to Utah?" And she is a prime example of somebody that's in a very high, powerful position at a large corporation in our community that, had she believed everything she heard and not come here to see that it's really not the way that it's perceived, she would not have her in the position that we have her in today. And we're so fortunate to have her there. Laura Kaiser, if you haven't figured out who that is. Just a huge contribution to IHC and to our economy. I do want to mention that this is something that is not going to go away after I continue my chairmanship as the chairman of chair, I'm not going to chair, I'm chair of the Salt Lake Chamber. This is something that will be sustainable. So in our business plan, we're creating ways that we will be fundraising and raising money to make sure that this mission can be accomplished and taken forward for several, many years until we reach an equality that is noticed throughout the country, and we will be able to bring talent, we'll have representation of equality in government, and we will have more women in the C-suite, and we will have more women sitting on paid corporate boards. The startup funds for this is coming from Zion Saint. We plan to contribute a significant amount of money for the startup, not only for the salaries and the operating expenses of the people that are going to be involved to help us make sure our mission is successful, but also for the programs that we want to bring in. These will not be programs necessarily that are just your ordinary programs. We're going to be bringing in people that are well-known speakers with very good resumes to help us with the mission that we are going to move forward with. As far as the Women's Corporate Board, what we're working on is we don't have to create it, which is always a nice thing, is there are already models out there with the Women's Corporate Board. There's an international organization where you can apply to have a chapter in your state. They provide a curriculum, courses that you would need to take to make sure that you understand that when you sign up to be on a corporate board, you understand your liability and your obligation. Because every day, no matter what kind of board you sit on, there's going to be more regulatory requirements and governance requirements that you feel that anybody, not just women, but anybody that sits on the corporate board will make sure they have to understand, because those board members are signing the board documents that go to the regulator of whichever company they're sitting on. So we think it's very, very important to provide a curriculum in governance and audit, governance and regulation, whatever industry you may be in, because every industry has regulators, some of us go to work, whether it's banking environment, the healthcare environment, but we need to make sure that everybody understands what those governance policies are so that we can make sure that we are contributing but more importantly, understanding our personal liability as we sit on those boards. A couple of things I just want to go over as far as what we believe is an economic impact is that we are an organization that is establishing a direct response to continued gender disparity found in the state and federal government and corporate America. The Women's Leadership Institute offers female leaders an opportunity to receive education and professional development to enable them to reach their full potential. when women who comprise 41.8% of manager and leadership roles and 51% of the total national population are provided an opportunity to earn equal pay and equal consideration for higher leadership positions, has the impact, the economic effect is absolutely undeniable. Let me give you some statistics to back that up. Our return on equity. On average, companies with the highest percentage of women board directors outperform those that don't have women directors by 53%. Our return on sales. On average, companies with the highest percentages of women board of directors outperform those with the least by 42%. And return on capital. On average, companies with the highest percentage of women board of directors outperform those with the least by 66%. And I also want to mention that Ushai is faced with a very unique problem. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country of 3.6, and is faced with the challenge of finding new talent in a pool of candidates who are already employed. Attracting talent from outside the state is a strategy that we have to utilize. We've already illustrated the economic impact women have on their company's bottom line, so it only makes sense to bring female candidates in an already underrepresented state population. But the biggest question arises, how does a state, which ranks second to last in gender equality nationally, attract top female candidates to occupy leadership roles in corporations and government? That's our mission. We need to change this. If we don't change this, this is going to absolutely have a negative impact on our economic growth and the way that we're perceived in the country and around the world. So I'll stop there and take questions and continue the conversation as we go.
Thank you for the presentation. I know I've got a myriad of questions because your presentation was so interesting, so it's iterative. But we do, I will defer to my other committee members first. Ms. Myron.
Thanks, Lori, for the information. It's very helpful. I'm wondering if you could, thank you, Representative Stevens, for the quick fix. Wondering if you could explain to the commission about how the organization is structured in terms of leadership and who you'll be having serve on the organization and how you expect that to work.
Okay, we will have a CEO, a woman CEO. We will also have a COO. We're calling those, we're putting them in those positions because they're C-suite positions. So everything we're doing is very intentional. In addition to that, we will have an executive committee that's made up of five people, including two people, Heidi Walker from the Chamber, Natalie Gottner from the University of Utah/Chamber, myself, Lauren Kaiser, Erin Evans, who is our marketing arm of the executive committee, and then the CEO and the COO are the executive committee. We are in the process of brainstorming and thinking of names of people to sit on our board of directors, which we will have. 50-50 men and women. Again, setting by example what we're trying to accomplish. And we will be seeking out both men and women that understand the desperate need that we have here in Utah and have the vision. I want to give an example of, we want someone like, I won't name names, but someone from a large corporation that has already expressed interest and said, I need the women in my organization to be able to take these courses, be more educated. I want them to run for government. I want them to be in the C-suite. I want them to be on the corporate boards. And so we're going to start out with a 10-member board of directors, five men and five women. As we grow and see the need, we will expand that board of director position. In addition to that, we will have a couple of two or three advisory boards because we don't want to exclude anybody in what we're doing. Our advisory boards will be made up of our interfaith communities to make sure that we're reaching out and getting support that we need and that they understand what we're doing. The second one will be from women that have chosen to stop their careers at some point in their life to raise their children and are going back to school and want to complete their education and at that point be able to receive a leadership position at some kind of organization or hopefully want to run for government because I believe that a woman that's very well educated will continue that the educational belief and the knowledge down to their children, even if they're grown children, by example. And we need to make sure that we're not just including professional women. So we will have an advisory board of women that have been out of the workforce. Maybe their entire part of their time because they decided that they were the ones that would stay home with the children. Or maybe they have gone and got part of their degree, raised their children. Their children are older now and they feel like they want to go back and get their degree. And we would like to have them come and give us their advice. The third advisory board will be, we will invite people from organizations that are doing something similar to what we're doing to make sure that everyone understands this is an inclusive group. It's not an exclusive group. We don't think we can do it better than anybody else. We need to make sure that we all join forces and make sure that we are all working towards the same goal. So those are the first three advisory boards that we've identified so far. So we need to make sure that we hear from those people to make the decisions going forward for the success of our Women's Leadership Institute.
Thanks. Well, just a brief follow-up, but I think it's a great opportunity for the Commission to collaborate with this new organization and how we can partner so that we're not doing, because many of the Commission's goals are related to leadership and advancement of women in leadership positions, whether in government or in business in the state of Utah. So how we can help each other and support each other on accomplishing our goals, I think, is important.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it. Representative Seale is returned by my call.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lori, for your presentation. You are in a room full of women who are very interested in advancing women's leadership in Utah in a variety of ways, and many of us work hard every day to do precisely that. So thank you for explaining about this new effort on the part of the business community. I think that that's very important. I agree that there is an economic development impact of not having women in leadership positions in corporations and in government. My question concerns the relationships that you envision with groups that have done and are doing some of this work currently, and the one that immediately comes to mind, of course, is Real Women Run, which is in its fourth year of work educating and training women around the state to run for elected political office, to serve on boards and commissions, to work on campaigns, and generally to become involved in political life. So as just that example, there are others. Springboard is another example, and other groups have been interested in this issue. So can you describe how you envision your relationship with efforts that are already underway to elect women to public office and to advance their leadership in our state?
I'd be happy to. As I mentioned earlier, we want to be inclusive of all of those groups. This is not, we have to work as a collaborative community to make sure that we are accomplishing, this is a huge goal. The percentages are so disturbing that it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort on a lot of people's parts. And so I definitely will admit that I don't think that any one group by itself can reach the levels that I would like to see it at, which are, I don't know if it will happen in my lifetime, but I would hope that we can reach towards the goal of having equality in 50-50 across the board, leadership, political, board of directors seats, C-suites. So I really see that we need to make sure that we stay in contact, make sure that we have a representative from those organizations on our advisory boards, make sure that there's someone that, if we're invited from a lot of different areas, to make sure that we're going out and collaborating with those other organizations so that they can see that, you know, oh, okay, you want to run with this way? You guys go that way, we'll make sure we don't go this way, but at the end, we're going to meet to make sure that we are going for the exact same goal. Because I think with all the different organizations, you mentioned a few, but there's probably 4, 5, 6 organizations that have been doing this, and they've been doing it longer. I don't want to take away from anything that they've already done. What we want to do is make sure that we learn from what maybe any mistakes they've made, learn from what's successful, and then with the masses, building a mass organization that where we can all work together, I think is going to be very important. So that's how I plan on doing it, is making sure that communication line is always open, whether we're at the existing organization, or we invite the other organizations to come in and sit down with us and give us advice. And as I mentioned, I think this is too important to try to duplicate efforts. We need to make sure that we're collaborating together to reach the goal that we all feel is very important. So that's how I see us doing that. And when I say that I'm here with the Salt Lake Chamber representing it today, it's really the Utah Chambers, because within the Salt Lake Chamber, there is an organization that brings together all of the Utah Chambers. So this is going to be a far-reaching with Utah, so it even brings us that there's additional organizations that have already been doing some of these things, and we want to make sure that we're involving them. Our hope actually is to even take it outside of Utah and into Idaho, because they don't have much better numbers. And I was up there for a presentation in my position with Science Bank. That was Sally Krawcheck, who has some unbelievable statistics that I would like to arrange. Somebody like that is somebody I'd like to bring in as a speaker for a program. Gina Davis, the work that she's doing to make sure that women are portrayed correctly in the media, and that we're not a character or a person in a film that has to be 22 waist and a 40 chest and 5'11" and what. She is working tirelessly and has a foundation to make sure that women take more leading roles as real women and not as the media has been portraying them. And she's taken on some pretty big media companies. So I say that because those are the two speakers that I've met, I've talked to in quite a bit of depth in Idaho. And I met also with the First Lady of Idaho and told her what I, and this was before we started to create it, but just what my thoughts were. And she said, we're working on the same thing here in Idaho, but we can't seem to get it off the ground. And so I told her that I would be working, talking to her and helping her and giving her a lot of ideas that we're working on so that hopefully we can make this more of a regional approach to make sure that we're well represented in the regional level and around the country, the state of Utah.
Ms. Barnum, you had your light on, I think, earlier. Is that correct, or did I imagine that? You did, or did I imagine it?
I did.
Okay. Good. Thanks for the psychological validation. Would you like to ask your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, I thought it was really interesting that you mentioned the focus that you have on the reputation Utah has outside of the state and the impact that it has on bringing more women or even businesses to the state. So as a representative of the chamber and in your discussions with GOED and EDC Utah, is that something that they're telling you they are hearing, or is that just something you're proactively anticipating, or it's like anecdotal things that you're hearing?
I believe they're hearing them. I just don't know that they know what to do about it. In my experience working with trying to help women progress, the men are not against it, but they just don't think about it. When you start talking to them about the economic impact and the things that we can do to change it, they go, okay. So it's just different. There's, you know, we all know that men and women's minds are not created equal. We think differently. We bring a different aspect and a different opinion to the table. And they're not hearing that because they're all hanging out with the same people that are just like them. But when you bring it to their attention and you say how important this is, and then and you provide statistics for them, how can they not say that this is something important? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm going to go back to my Zions Bank hat for just a minute. I use Scott Anderson as a perfect example, and Harris Simmons, our CEO and chairman. We have women represented on our board of directors. We have women represented on our executive committee. I can say that we probably are very close to these percentages, but Scott sees that it needs to be better because he sees the value of a difference of opinion. If you're sitting in a room of people, if you hire people that are all like you, and that's why you hire them, because you don't think you're going to get any pushback from them, then they're going to have the same opinion as you do, and nothing's going to change. We need to bring in more diversity into those conversations, and when they start seeing how that diversity will really help move their company along, then they get the aha moment.
It seems to me, the reason I asked the question too is, as we think about how we can affect policy and getting more traction with a largely male representation in the elected officials. If Val Hale went to the governor and said, gee, this company was primed and ready to come to the state, and then they looked at our women in leadership numbers, I mean, it seems to me like that would be just that little trigger that can really start
a serious conversation about what do we need to do from a policy standpoint. So I just wanted to make sure that we touched on what you actually knew, maybe concrete information that you might know.
We've had little snippets of conversations with Val, but we will be having a very long conversation with him, and he's very interested. So we've just kind of given him all of those teasers of, you know, this is what we're doing, and did you ever think of this, and did you ever think of that? We're trying to just get people to just start thinking about what we're doing and what we need to accomplish, and then we'll sit down with them and say, this is how important it is. These are the statistics, and this is where we want to be. And again, I hope the same thing that Val will say to the governor, along with his commission, to say, you know, this is serious. And again, I cannot stress enough that we ever call it this a women's issue. This is not a women's issue. It is an economic development issue for the state of Utah. The way that we're looked at, the way that we're viewed, and the way that the only way we're going to attract good talent into the state.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And do any other commission members have any questions before I start on my trail of wonderment and inquiry?
All right.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for taking your time to come here today. It's not easy. We'll come up here. We have half the Capitol secured in plastic. It looks like an experimental zone. There's no parking. It's cold and early. We greatly appreciate you coming here today and talking with us and collaborating with us as well. I'll start with the nuts and bolts question and then go into a little bit of my political theory bent. Just to clarify, I've got noted, which may or may not be correct, so that's why I'm trying to verify. The Women's Leadership Institute, you all plan on focusing on more equity in political positions throughout the state. I would assume that would be anywhere from local all the way up to gubernatorial, statewide sort of focus, and corporate boards.
And also federal.
Okay.
So we need to get more women in D.C. To try to get some sanity in D.C.
And then you had mentioned C-suite positions. My understanding of that is that those are chief positions in a commercial or private sector organization, like CEO, things of that nature. Is my understanding correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So what have you all, and I understand this is in its nascent stages as well, too, and very organic, have you all talked about the areas or points in people's lives when they enter into the workforce at first, like entry-level positions and navigating up through organizations at that point, or just at the point where one may be ready to take on a leadership position within the organization?
We talked about that at quite some extent in the beginning conversation. And we believe that there are several organizations that already are in Utah that are helping young women be prepared to go in, and they're helping them with their resume, they're helping them understand how they should dress, the way they should present themselves. And so there's a lot of organizations helping the young women. But one thing that you did mention that I know there are several organizations that are doing, including Science Bank, KPMG, CBIZ, a lot of the big companies that are trying to attract women and grow women within their own organization. They have women's groups to help them. They have mentorship programs, so that they're tied up to a mentor that's a woman leader to help them get to that position. They have programs, they have training programs, they have speakers and leadership speakers coming in. I'll give you an example at Science Bank.
We have 8 regions in Utah and Idaho, and each region has a women's business forum that is represented by about 8 women in that region. They go out to their, what we call their opinion leaders, which are the women that we know will tell us what they think. What do you want? What do you need to feel like you are supported in developing your career at Science Bank? We want you to stay at Science Bank. And that program has helped us retain more women since it started in about 5 years ago than we've ever had prior to that. I had a meeting with women at KPMG, both locally and from outside the state. I'm not thinking of the woman's name, but KPMG, but she's the head of the Girl Scouts. Now she just got put into that position. And she wants to be involved in what we're doing, and she wants our help in helping them create a similar program that we have at Zions Bank so that they can do the same thing at KPMG. CDIS, Mary Kay Griffith, is nationally the head of their women's program to make sure that the women that work in the CPA areas are being groomed so that they can become partners. So if we can get more organizations to do that, and then in addition to the other organizations that are helping with that outside of the organization, we feel like that piece of it is being met. We really want to, the gap really is this higher part of where the glass ceiling hits the heads of some of these women, and they don't feel like they can go further into a C-suite position, a leadership position, or sit on a corporate board and be paid for it for the value that they bring, or have the confidence and understand the intricacies of running for government and what it takes to run for government positions. So that's where we feel is the biggest gap that we want to concentrate on. If we try to make it too, we've had several conversations, if we try to make it too broad, we're not going to reach any of our objectives very quickly. So we decided to narrow it down to 2 things and work on those 2 things vigorously, and then as we get further along and we start seeing progress, we may add to our piece and our mission of building our bench strength. Because where are the women that we need to identify that are going to take over for us? And how are we going to make sure that they're well qualified and well trained? So we've talked about that piece of it, but we're kind of leaving that as maybe a phase 2. So that we can get the first 2 things that are the most significantly important parts of what our mission is underway before we start going to the bench strength. But that definitely is something that we want to talk about. And I think the way that we can do that is go to some of the organizations and the corporations in the state and say, we'd like, if you have a succession plan, and every corporation has a succession plan, send the women that are in your succession plan to our trainings and let us help them. And because if you don't have a women's organization within your own organization and you have women that are on your succession plan, the likelihood of them reaching their full potential quickly is not as good as if you have some outside training.
I would agree. And I appreciate your assessment of it. I do, I also understand the dangers of mission creep, although I do know that it's all a continuous process, right? And sometimes people end up entering the workforce for the first time not as a young person either, for whatever reason. So, at any rate, I appreciate your awareness of that. Secondly, I also, a lot of the commission members had asked the question about the collaboration and the group, which is Real Women Run, and I do, and our commission itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that we all need to work together on this and leverage our individual areas of expertise to make this a success, because it is a heavy push. And so far, and we're going to be talking about it later on in our meeting, about really honing in on our focus. And up to this point, a lot of it has been in the public policy realm and in the public sector. And that is different in many ways than the private sector for a whole bunch of different reasons. And I would hope that we can continue to work together with that, because even though they are different, we all live together in the same space, and those are two huge entities that have to work together with it. The other part of that is that we could really use some collaborative help, and Ms. Barnum hit on this as well, related to some of our public policy goals that we've identified, because there are glitches in the system that actually serve to be barriers to women and do not create an level playing field for them to be able to be successful. We will need help making those changes occur, not only from a statutory and regulatory perspective, but also from a budgetary perspective as well. Some of the issues that we have hit on as important include Utah Futures. We have also done a deep dive related to the Division of Workforce Services and education and training programs for women and families on assistance. In working together and in bridging some of the silos that occur in government, not only within the state level, but in a federalist system about how the feds interact with the state and with localities, we've identified ways where programs are conflictual or not helping, and they end up not taking care of their mission. And it would be helpful to have you all group assist us in those discussions. And yes, I believe that GOED would be helpful in talking about this and framing this from an economic development standpoint. But it's also our voices as well, too. And I think that that's exceedingly important, so that we learn to impact the systems ourselves and not always have another messenger have to take that for us. You had mentioned that when you have talked to men, it's been in your experience that they're not against this, because you too have framed it as economic development. And in passing this bill and running this bill and all the stakeholders behind it, I absolutely insisted that we talk about winning. Some people care about fairness and equity, other people do not. But what they do care about is being competitive. And if we cannot do that on a local, state, or global level, we're just going to lose. And I firmly believe that. I have a question about intersectionality, which is kind of a technical term about women and what do we mean by women. And you mentioned diversity, and I think that's awesome, and it's obviously in your mindset about how to bring this all together. What are your thoughts related to people of color and also involving different socioeconomic groups of women within the discussions of your awesome efforts related to this?
I think we'll be able to accomplish that through our advisory boards. As I mentioned, when I say all the interfaith, we want to make sure that all the interfaith are represented and we hear their voices. Secondly, as far as the different economic levels of women and diverse minorities. I put women and minorities in separate categories, because at 51% of the population, we are not a minority. So I say women and minority. But we will be making sure that we reach out to the groups of minorities, mainly women.
And I should have been more clear, and I apologize, I was not. So what I'm specifically talking about are women of color and how they will be integral within the organization, and maybe not just groups that we go to say, hey, what do you think about, but how can we build this in a way that takes their perspective as well, too? And I'm sorry, I wasn't clear earlier.
the way that I see it is, as I mentioned before, we are going to start with 10 board members, 5 men, 5 women, and we want to make that board as diverse as possible. And if we can't do it right with the first 10, I see that rapidly. I don't want to make it the board too big, because when you have a great big group of people, it's hard to really come to a consensus for an action item. So I want to keep it to a level where we can all discuss something and have takeaway action items for all. This will be a working board. So it will be something that everybody can casually take away and make action on. But we definitely want to make sure that we include all kinds of diversity on our board of directors.
Great, that's awesome. And then one last question probably relates to the hierarchy of the organization. So much of what we have established is based on a male-dominated society, and that includes hierarchy. I would just strongly encourage that, as you're also taking on the rest of the world, to consider a bullet point of the hierarchical organization and how that feeds into what already exists. If I'm making sense. If we can entertain different opportunities for restructuring, that can also help create a space where everyone can compete, gender, whatever. So I would just ask that perhaps that some of the contemplation of the organization is actually the organizational structure.
Of our specific, yeah. And as I mentioned, the executive committee is all women because we all came together and said, this is a big problem. But the board of directors, I think the reason that I believe this is coming at a very good time, not only because of all the media that's been focused on Utah lately. We started this before that even started, but when those media threads came out and we just started emailing them all back and forth, we were just dying. But that's why it's so important for us to make sure that we have men that are talking the same talk that we talk, so that they can talk to the people in their or other organizations that they represent, because when you think about it, a lot of the men that we're reaching out to be on the board of directors will be involved in corporate boards. They can take our voice, right, because they understand it. We can give them all the ammunition that they need to go to the corporate board that they may be sitting on and talk to that organization to say, okay, let's talk about the diversity of this board. So I think the hierarchy of what we're doing, it's all in our hands. Lane, while he's a wonderful person with a lot of experience. Sometimes, for example, when he says, I think this is a great women's issue you want to work on. You just have to keep reminding him. The other thing, and I'm just going to say this just to let you know how I talk to Lane, is when he introduced me as the third woman, being very boastful and proud, that I was going to be the third woman chair of the Salt Lake Chamber in 100 years. I walked up to him afterwards and I said, don't ever say that again. Because you think you are patting yourself on the back because of that, it's actually embarrassing us. Because we should have had many more than three women in 100 years being the chair of the Board of Governors of the Chamber of Commerce. And so he was like, oh, geez, I just didn't think of that. We just have to make sure that we remind them we're not being rude, we're not being, we are women here as roar, we are. But, let's just talk about where the rubber meets the road. And so I just give that an example as far as our hierarchy. The executive committee is running this organization with the other organizations that we'll be tying into.
Great. I think what is the best way in your mind for us to communicate our organization and,
I think that we should have a meeting on whether we meet on a regular basis with somebody from this commission, have them invite them to our board of directors meetings so that then they can come back and report to the commission about things that we're doing. If you see that we're going a direction that you just think is absurd, I would want to hear that back from you. But then also, I would like to have the communication come the other way, so that we can have somebody that comes and sits on the commission on a regular, not regular, but as a liaison, so that we can make sure we understand what you're doing on a regular basis, so that we can, when there's something that we all feel strongly about, that we are, that we can push and really get there, that we come together as both groups and say, this is how we're going to do it, this is how we need to fund it, and this is what we're going to do to take action. So I really see us as the two groups having a liaison on both sides so that we are in constant communication and working towards the same goals.
Okay, perfect. And then this is, just to be clear in my own mind, this is a Chamber of Commerce effort. And then explain to me again about the role of Zions within this. But although Zions is a member of the Chamber as well, too. So what does that look like?
Zions Bank is funding the program for the first 2 years, both for programming for all of the events that we're having and the speakers that we'll be bringing in. We're also providing the salary and benefits for the two people that are the CEO and the COO. And then, so part of our plan that we're working on right now is how do we make that sustainable after Zions Bank has paid for the first 2 years of the program. And that will be through, corporations with the Fed sponsorship, memberships to the curriculum to help through the training and things like that. But we may come up with other things, but we do need to be thinking about how we're going to make this sustainable.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Does anyone else have any other questions? Okay. Again, thank you so much.
I appreciate your attention for having me.
We will be in touch related to the liaison. I think that's an excellent idea, and later on when we're going over some committee business, I'll talk to the commission about that. And I look forward to future conversations with you. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Next item, Welcome Center. It's good to see you. I'd also like to recognize Representative Chavez Houck, who's here today. Thank you. And that would be Senator Henderson. Next agenda item is mentor program. Sammy Getz. A small note of committee business. It is cold in here.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Barnum, for validating me. maybe it was just me. So we're trying to take care of that right now.
All right, well, good morning, and thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it. I hope your mornings are starting off well. And by the way, I love the way you guys are good at time. This is fantastic. It's like barely after 9, so I'll try to keep on time here. And so as a follow-up, I'm going to kind of just give you a kind of an update on what we've been doing with the mentoring program since we met last. About 2 weeks ago, the Women's Tech Council had their advisory board meeting, and in that meeting, I followed up with them just to confirm commitment that they were engaged and wanted to work with us on this project, and they are very enthusiastic, and I kind of framed it up for them as saying that what we'd like to have is Women in the Economy Commission be the vision and leadership for this to help us, input on strategy, help us define outcomes, and ensure that the outcomes that we're looking to drive towards and the data we want to collect to demonstrate those outcomes tested the best ones that we can possibly do for the mentor program. And that the Women's Tech Council are basically kind of the worker bees. They're the heavy lifters out in the community, since there's a greater number of them. And they were very, very excited to take on that role and work with the commission. And so we are a definite yes there. And one of the things that came out of that meeting was the idea that we really don't know what's going on out in our community. We don't know what type of mentoring activities are going on, who's doing them, are they collecting data, are they effective, having the right impact, getting the right target audience. And so what we decided to do is work together to provide some woman power, I guess you might say, to get some interns to do some asset mapping, to do some surveying and collect data, and look at the types of mentoring activities. And we initially defined those mentoring activities as kind of your traditional one-on-one individual or companies that bring in groups of girls to do mentoring. Our other shadows, job shadows, internships, we're looking at those as mentoring opportunities. Actual activities and programs, such as, I don't know if anyone here has ever had the chance to be involved in Expanding Your Horizons, EYH, which ATK has been doing for probably the better part of 11, 12 years up at Mount Ogden, and we expanded it about 6-7 years ago down into Salt Lake Valley for some of our girls. It's a one-day event. We're looking at those. Westminster College does a great math camp called Awesome for Girls. There's the Access Program. We know there are lots of great mentoring programs out there, but I'm sure there are more that we don't know about. So it's kind of the attitude of, and we also, there are two other things we've looked at, advocacy and sponsorship. And those are really for young women that are in the workplace, that we could look for companies that are really doing a good job of providing that sponsorship and advocacy for them to achieve bigger and greater things in companies. And then one thing that's really has me intrigued, particularly in the next topic I'll talk about, is the online or kind of e-mentoring programs that are very innovative that are out there that might be working, because they really do give us a scale, an ability to scale and get greater impact. So we're looking at putting a survey out. Caitlin Felstead, who's our marketing communications coordinator in the STEM Action Center, has put together a very, very quick survey, working with Women's Tech Council, Utah Technology Council, other trade organizations like Utah Manufacturers. Let's see what we get there. But BioUtah is trying to get this out to universities, to companies, to cultural community partners, and try to gather as much information in the next month and a half to find out what's going on. So we need to know what we have, and more importantly, we need to find out what we don't have, what's missing. And when we do find out what we have, we need to find out who's collecting the data, who's doing something that we know, if we were able to scale or replicate, that it's going to be the right thing to scale and replicate, and put investment and time, and if there are other resources, we know it's the right place to be doing that. And so, and I suspect in my past experience, we're going to be looking at a shortage of really valuable internships for our young girls to get into the career and workplace opportunities. And I know that we don't have a lot of the online mentoring that could reach some of our girls that aren't necessarily in with the easy access of universities, perhaps. And so our timeline on that is loosely towards the end of January. We'd like to have some information to be able to look at and say, where do we need to begin to build our strategy? And then finally, if you look at what I just provided to you, the handout that I put together, in the last time I presented, there was a request to look and see what other states are doing something valuable that's showing impact, that's data-driven, outcome-driven. And so working with the National Bureau of STEM Connector, they helped me find a couple of states that they thought, through the Million Women Mentors Program, that was doing a good job. And so I reached out to an individual in Texas, and then an individual in Tennessee. I have not yet heard back from Tennessee, but I did spend about a week ago, 2 hours on the phone with Tricia Berry from Texas, and I was incredibly impressed with some of the innovative online strategies that they've been using in Texas. And some of them, they've drawn upon from a national program and have made them Texas style. And I think that they really have the potential to be adapted to Utah. And I just listed my 5 favorites because they had more, but I wanted to really dial in after I looked at the online information and talked to her a little bit more. And I listed 5. Some of them are quite, or much less technically challenging to get in place. The first one, 5 of them, I think, are asset mapping that we're doing, the data we're collecting from what's going on in our state can feed into this and create this is a database that allows for individuals, professionals, to voluntarily put a profile in. And then it creates the search for database for young girls to go in and find role models, to read about women in roles of leadership and certain professions they might be interested in. And I think we could populate, we can make that database whatever we want. It could be profiled or entered. It could be a searchable database of activities that are going on. If parents want to find out what activities on the weekend are out there for the girls to be exposed to careers and activities, hands-on activities, summer activities, it could be, you have a dual purpose, depending upon what we decide. The second one, role models matter. This is really an online kind of virtual workshop opportunity for those individuals who want to get involved in mentoring. They don't necessarily know what it involves, what it looks like, how to be the most effective mentor. And for some of us, I know that seems like, well, being a mentor, we do it every day with our children at home. But perhaps for some of our parents out in some of our communities, this would be helpful for them to understand that they can be a powerful mentor within their own community. So this could be customized to what we think our needs are. I've looked at it. I really love the workshop. I think it could be streamlined to be a little bit more time-sensitive, pretty long ones. But that's another nice model. NEFRIS is an interesting one. It's a fairly new program. They are collecting data, from what I could tell. And it's really more of an industry-centric program where industry people just go in and put profiles in. And again, it's very similar to FAFSA. These two, we might want to look and see, you know, which one do we think has the most impact with the investment of time created. STEMfire is fairly new. It was created by North Texas Group out of Dallas. They're collecting data mostly in participation, but it's an interesting one. It really matches. This is more matching STEM professionals to classroom needs. So if a teacher would like to get access to speakers, to opportunities for field trips to hook their kids up with professional community. And it's more student-centric, more classroom-centric. And we're only doing something very similar at the STEM Action Center, so this could be some well-being that we could work towards. And finally, my favorite, which is probably would take the most time, is MentorNet. I like this one for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the most mature. It's been around for at least 20 years. It was a program that was funded by the National Science Foundation. I talked to the program director at NSF. They've been collecting years of data for this particular program, and it's impact data, not just participation data, which I really, really like. And they are willing to help us, you know, create a Utah version of it, working with the internet. What it is, it's really a match.com in every sense. It uses an algorithm to match up mentor and mentee profiles so that they can really, a young girl or even a professional that's looking for some mentorship to create more leadership or management skills can get that perfect match. And what they do ongoing monitoring. In this particular program, they have individuals that check in and say, hey, you know, if you talk to your mentee, or if you check in with your mentor, how are things going? And so it really provides some ongoing support. And I like this one. It's a little more intensive. It would take more time to build out, but I think it's more data-driven, and it would get us into a more long-term, sustainable, high-impact program if we were to invest the time in it. There are many more programs, I'm sure, out there. We're probably going to find a lot within our own backyard that we could use to replicate or build more capacity on and support it. But this is so far what we've got, and I will say it's been interesting. The governor did a women in business roundtable earlier this week, I think. Time flies. This week's been a frenzy of meetings from holiday break. But I have to admit, when I came and talked to you for us the first time, the whole Million Women Mentors, which is the national effort that's going on a state by state, being participation coming into this national dialogue and pledging mentors on a state level basis. I have to admit, I didn't see that as the most important part of this. I saw that as kind of that carrot to reach for, but the reason to be able to build back up and build a state-level strategy and network. After hearing some of the concerns and comments of the women as they were in that roundtable, and some of the most recent not-so-nice press we've had about women in Utah and our focus on women in Utah, I've changed my mind a little bit. I think getting a state pledge into the Million Women Mentors into that national dialogue is probably pretty important. I think the absence of Utah being one of the few states that has not made a pledge it has the risk of confirming that we really do deserve some of that bad press that's out there. So what I would like to do in the next couple of weeks is work with in our team and actually make a state pledge. And we can make one that's reasonable, but at least getting Utah at that national dialogue, that we're not the state that's missing in pledging, you know, 2,000 mentors over the next 4 years. I mean, certainly we could come up with 2,000 people in the state in 4 years that are willing to put 40 hours in a year to mentoring in some capacity. My guess is once we get our asset map and information in a month and a half, we'll probably have already cataloged that, you know, people that have put that many hours in usually at least have that. So I do plan on putting a state pledge in, which I think will give us a nice goal to work towards. And it's not too hard. We have at least three and a half years, 4 years to work towards that. But at least Utah won't be asking for a national dialogue that other states have already stepped up. So that's where we are. I'd like to, once we get our asset map and data in, start working on a strategic plan of what we're missing and what we need to build out on and support more of. Any questions?
How can I help?
Well, in the next, what we have to do is kind of do our homework over the next month and a half, get our asset mapping data in, start to look and see what we have and put together, you know, kind of categorize and some information on that. What I'd like to do is come back to the committee when we're ready with, I can send it early if you look at proposed outcomes that we're looking for. So if we do build out a statewide strategy, what should change? I'd like to get your input. Maybe if we have a little more time to discuss outcomes for mentoring and what we would like to do at the end of, say, the first year of implementing a few targeted activities, building out on websites perhaps. But being able to look at our strategy and say, you know, I think this looks good with your timeline and the benchmarks. Those outcomes look good. And I can put that together. I'd just like to have this commission look at it and provide input on that. Would that be reasonable?
Okay,
I think that. Okay, you're ringing in my own ears.
I think that, is this better if I lean all the way back? I think that sounds very reasonable. I have two requests.
You bet.
I have 2.5 requests. One, that the mentors are not, that we focus not only on private sector, but also public sector professionals as well, too.
You bet.
Women in government, not only elected, but people who are public administrators. Secondly, yesterday I spoke at a Women in Water group luncheon. They're engineers in public utilities. Pretty amazing. They were very, very frustrated because most of the women there have engineering degrees that have to deal with water. And they got into that because it's an area of interest to them occupationally, but they're not finding the space professionally in the offices to support them. So STEM means also getting a degree, but also supporting a group of women that are entering a field that is largely male-dominated. And we talk about that in terms, I think, a lot of in labor, and there's misconceptions about women and heavy equipment and things like that. It was just absolutely wrong. But also this carries over into the engineering field, too. And so I think a lot of times when we, in my head, conceptualized mentoring, it's with young people. And I believe that there is an opportunity for everyone to have a mentor. And no matter whether or not they're re-entering the workplace or maybe they're in a space where they need help and guidance and a strategy to be able to navigate an area that is not friendly. So that would be my request.
And that could fit very well. I think the Women's Tech Council perhaps they could help drive something like that out of their organization. I can just think about that.
Okay. Does anyone else have any other questions or insights? Senator Henderson.
Thank you. So, you know, in addition, I love the idea of mentoring. I think it's really important.
in not only teaching business skills or different industry skills, but the leadership skills, communication skills, public speaking, negotiating skills. It can be very intimidating to be in an environment where there are a lot of people who do things differently, think differently than you do, have a lot of practice at doing it. It can be very inhibiting, and I think making sure that mentoring includes leadership development, I think, is critical in anything that any woman decides to do, even just in her interpersonal life. That those are skills that are really hard to find naturally, but can be developed in people. And learning how to step out of their comfort zone and push themselves a little bit in those areas can be very, very beneficial long run. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. I totally agree with you on that. Interesting thing, I just wanted to end this with when we were in the roundtable with the governor and this amazing group of women involved in different types of business and academia and leadership roles. A colleague of mine, she's the AG for Office of Human Rights, was there, and we work with her through an action center for any legal issues that we need help with. And she made a very interesting comment on a request, which made me think of this commission. She said, can we do a women in government roundtable with the governor to express the issues in the public sector? And so it was kind of interesting. I thought that would be very interesting to hear about. But I thought of this commission when she suggested that, having been in government for many years as a woman. Thanks so much.
We have one more question.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Dr. Robinson.
It's me over here.
Okay.
I really just have a request, and that would be that you add a focus for women of color in this program and just be certain that we pay attention to women of color when you're doing the mentoring program. And possibly with this MentorNet and that algorithm that they have set up, that it would match women of color with a mentor of color as well to help them with those additional barriers or challenges that they could be facing.
I appreciate that. Thanks. I just had a fantastic meeting with Representative Shadows Hap the other day, and she gave me some great ideas on how to work with Hispanic and Latino girls, but within a community context, bring the parents into that too, which I think having perhaps the mentoring support for parents in some capacity that's sensitive
So I would add, and I'm sure representative could share this, but to be culturally aware of the differences of women of color, so the importance of family and community for Hispanic women, and similar things with family, Polynesian family.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great observation. Thank you for partnering with us.
Thanks for your help. This is our office is pretty passionate about this, given the fact that we're all women and that's just their approach.
DWS Public Assistance Program update. I will identify this as DWS staff, and if you all could introduce yourselves.
Just to recap for the commission, last time we discussed this issue, the big focus on our discussion related to two areas. One were services related to child care and also education and training programs. And one of the big enthusiastic and emphatic requests that came out of the speaker was to have a matrix that identified the program, the state role in the program, either statutory or administrative role, and then also the federal role in this, because we were finding that there were barriers to success based on some of the parameters of the program, like whether or not someone could connect with education opportunities or length of benefit or qualifications for benefits that just did not seem to make any sort of rational sense to any of us sitting here. So, that is what we're following up with today. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And members of the commission.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the Commission. I'm Tracy Gruber. I'm the Director of the Office of Child Care and the Senior Advisor on the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative at the Department of Workforce Services.
I'm Kathy Bonas, and I am the General Counsel for the Department, and I also am their Director of Legislative Affairs.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to come back today to follow up on several questions that you had for us at the last commission meeting. We have some additional information on childcare that we hope will address your questions and, of course, afford you the opportunity to ask us some additional questions. I believe in your packet you should have two documents that are related to the Office of Child Care, and I will just touch briefly on those as I go through my presentation. One is a very colorful infographic, and the other is a chart that says Child Care Development Block Grant.
Representative Felix is modeling these documents for you at the time.
So not to overwhelm you all with more data, I will only give you a couple of data points that I think most of us are familiar with in this room. Pew did a research study that got a lot of attention not that long ago, showing that 4 in 10 women nationally are the primary breadwinners of their families. 63% of these primary breadwinners are single moms with children under the age of 18. The population that we primarily serve in the Department of Workforce Services, particularly in the Office of Child Care, are single moms because most of our programs require a dependent present in the household. So they are single mothers. And these parents, not surprisingly, need child care, especially if we want them and we encourage them to be contributing members of the economy. So some additional data that's provided on the infographic that I'm not going to walk through talks about the high cost of child care, and those are some of the issues that we're confronting. It also gives you a distribution of our child care programs and where we are serving children through those programs, either through the Family Employment Program, through employment support child care, and it just gives you the distribution, which shows that most of our children are being served for parents who are in the workforce and they need child care support. The Office of Child Care is almost 100% funded through a federal grant called the Child Care Development Fund. We do receive about $4 million of maintenance of effort money through the state in order to get our money, all of our money from the feds, and we also identify matching dollars throughout the community through small county government, city government, that allows us to draw down another component of our grant. The Child Care Development Fund is an extremely flexible fund. Some of the federal funds that we get are not flexible, but this is a block grant. So the goals of the Child Care Development Fund established by the federal government is that there's lots of state flexibility to create that program. It really promotes parental choice and emphasizes parental choice in consumer education so they can make educated decisions about what setting they would like their child to be in to serve the needs of their families. The program is also designed, and the grant promotes self-sufficiency for family members to move them off public assistance, and child care is designed to help promote that. And then, of course, our grant is also utilized to ensure that the environments that children are in are healthy and safe and promote emotional development, and we do that through our relationship with the Department of Health. In order for Utah to meet those goals, the two biggest components of our program are providing subsidies for low-income families and then also utilizing our funds to ensure that child care settings are providing, as I said, healthy, safe, developmentally appropriate environments for children. Although the Block grant is incredibly flexible. We do have some parameters that are given to us through the federal government, and the chart that you have in your packets goes in much greater detail than what I am going to go through presenting today. But I'm happy to answer any questions if you want to take some time to go through that document. And I'm just going to highlight some of those federal requirements and talk about how Utah is interpreting them. At least 70% of our grant must be spent on subsidies to low-income families. We are required to allow subsidy. The ceiling the feds tell us is you can provide subsidy to families up to 85% of the state median income. That's the ceiling. The state can go lower than that, and Utah does. Subsidies provided to child care providers, if they're paid on their based on their rates, is, again, the federal government provides for us a ceiling of 70% of the local market rate, and that's established by a state market rate survey that's done every 2 years, and we're about to get another one in the next couple of months. We have to spend some of that subsidy money to support support families in working, training, and education. Again, no specific guidelines. We are required to ask for co-payments from families in certain circumstances, but encouraged to waive co-payments for people who are living at the federal poverty level and lower. And we do that for our families that are participating in the Family Employment Program, which is our TANF program. We also are required to spend a minimum of 4% on quality. So again, we have two components of our program, subsidy and quality, to ensure that the environments the kids are in are of high quality, despite the fact that they have economic challenges. We're also required to set aside certain amounts of our funds for infant toddler quality specifically, because that's an area that the feds have great concern about the conditions for infant top quality care. Quality expansion grants, which again is in addition to that 4% and has to do with improving quality in these environments.
We've got a question.
Sure.
Senator Henderson.
I can wait until she's
okay.
Done with this, because it's about that, but wait, I'll wait until you're done.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
And then we also have requirements to engage in school-age child care, which is after-school programs, summer programs, and have a child care resource and referral system. As I mentioned earlier, one of the goals is consumer education, and our child care resource and referral system provides that consumer education for parents. So how does Utah use these guidelines? We do have, on the subsidy side, an employment support child care program. It requires at least 15 hours of work per week of the parent, and of course there's income eligibility thresholds to enter that program. I mentioned that the federal government allows for us to go up to 85% of state median income. Our subsidy program to enter is 56% of state median income, and you can stay in the program up to 70% of state median income. So we do not go up to that 85% threshold. Under the employment support child care, one of the questions that came up at the last meeting and where I misstated was that we didn't have education-supported child care. We do have education-supported child care, but we have a work requirement attached to that education-supported child care. And that work requirement is that minimum of 15 hours, and if you're meeting that minimum work requirement, then you can have up to 2 years of education-supported child care as long as you're meeting that requirement.
When you say education-supported child care, what does that mean?
It means that if the parent is pursuing an education or job training while they're also working, we will provide child care subsidies to cover those hours where you're in school or going to job training classes for up to 2 years.
Okay.
Thank you. Yep. Something new that we're doing this year, which aligns with some new regulations and the new rules that are coming out by the feds, which I'll talk about a little bit later, is something called job search child care. If we have parents that are working a minimum of 32 hours a week and they lose their job, we will provide child care support for them for 2 months. That is really not only in the interest of the parent, but also provides continuity of care for that child so they're not bouncing around. 1 month they have child care, the next 10 months they don't. We're providing that for 2 months, and we are adding another component to that job search child care, which is to give an option to the parent if they want help from somebody within DWS. We have a staff person who will work one-on-one with that family member to help get them reemployed during that period of time. And we're really excited about that. I mentioned already the state median income eligibility requirements. I also had said that the federal government allows us, or in court recommends, that we pay providers up to 70% of the local market rate. After last year's legislative session, where we had pursued and wanted to budget a higher state market rate for our providers, we raised what was between 40 and 50% to our providers, now to 60%. And that makes a big difference for providers and their willingness to accept children who are receiving subsidy. But it's still 10% lower than the recommendation by the feds. But again, it's not a rule. Our co-payments of that 56 and 70% are based on family size and income. And as I mentioned, there's no co-payment for families participating in the family employment program. And for those families that are transitioning from the family employment program to self-sufficiency, they do not have to pay a co-payment for 6 months. Thank you. I assume that you're calling on me since my...
I am. I can't figure out how to turn on my mic. Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I want to go back to something that you mentioned at the beginning of your presentation, and that was trying to help families move off public assistance. Could you describe how you do that? Because I know sometimes... And it's really unfortunate when it's set up this way, and a lot of programs are set up this way, that if you exceed a certain income, you lose all of your benefits. So do we have a way to wean people off so that it's beneficial for them to have a raise instead of hurt them to get a raise?
Yes, thanks for the question. Currently, because parents enter in at 56% of the state's median income, they are still eligible for child care subsidy up to 70% of the state median income. So there is a slowdown. Now, I will say that the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant, which just happened in November, is really encouraging states to pay very close attention to that and allow families to continue to receive subsidy up to that 85% threshold. So once we start evaluating all of those new requirements that will come with the reauthorization, I think we are going to be reevaluating how that phase down occurs. But some states say you come in at this amount, and once you go over that amount, you lose your benefits. Utah has established its system so you come in at 56% and you continue to receive up to 70%. And as your income grows, your co-payment increases. I think some families will say their co-payment increases too much, and it's something that we have to be aware of.
So the amount of benefits they're getting doesn't necessarily decrease, but their co-payment increases, so it kind of meters that out. But I mean, to me, it seems like rather than just turning off the spigot, as income goes up, the benefit, I don't know if federal regulations allow you to do this, but the benefit goes down a little bit so that at the high threshold, and maybe the threshold needs to be raised a little bit, but at some point, it's beneficial for them to get a raise, and they actually get the raise rather than suddenly have to pay all of this child care by themselves. So I don't know. I just wonder if we are implementing, it sounds like to a degree we are implementing something like that that kind of helps people rather than hurts them as they make more money in it.
Yeah, the cliff effect is a very serious issue for our families. We want them to become self-sufficient and encourage them to make a higher wage. The 85% is a threshold cap at the federal level, and we are not permitted to use funds over to pay for subsidies once a family exceeds that 85% of the state median income. But to phase them out over time is something that we have looked at, and I think we will, once we get guidance from the feds about this new law, think about even a slower phase out of the program.
Will you, by any chance, have any information on this during the session, legislative session, that you...
Yes, it's something that I also would like, you know, involvement for. We should be getting better instructions from the federal government by the end of January, where they're having a big meeting to talk about this and more instruction. And we will have to establish a state plan based on these new rules by June 30. So we will have that information, and I fully anticipate that we'll be briefing the legislature on the changes to the Child Care Development Fund, because there are a lot newer requirements, very child-focused, family-focused requirements, but with our grant, we will be balancing how we can do all of that, and we'll be seeking input to figure out the best way to do that while helping working families and also the children to stay in quality child care settings.
We've got another question. Thank you, Senator. Dr. Robinson.
Okay, thanks, Tracy, for being here. I have a question about the employment support child care, and can we talk about that for just a minute? And the requirement that you only have a 2-year time frame to complete education or get education. We know it takes at best 4 years to get a college degree going full time. But it's typical in our state that it takes between 5 and 6 years to complete a bachelor's degree. Is that 2-year time limit a federal regulation, federal law, state statute, administrative rule, or DWS policy?
It's in our administrative rules.
Okay.
It's not a federal law.
Okay. Okay. So, Jen, Representative Seeley, goes back to our discussion last meeting about the importance to be able to complete an education and the limitations that are placed on it that really prohibit somebody from advancing their education and getting into the workplace in their field of study and being successful economically for them and their families. And this is a concern to me again.
I would absolutely agree. Where is that on here somewhere?
Yes, it is. Actually, I should have the glasses on.
Let me see where I can find it.
Because I put the either the code or the policy. So it's on the first page, employment support child care to families who are income eligible, and then right underneath it it says up to 2 years of education, and then it cites the administrative rule that is relevant to that.
I'm sorry, where I cannot tell.
It should be on the first page.
I'm looking at
it's second from the bottom. In the middle column where it says state policy.
Ah, okay.
Up to 2 years of education support chapter.
Okay.
And then it says the administrative rule for that.
Okay, so what are our steps to change that?
Well, I think going back to the reauthorization and getting further instruction on our new law, if it gets implemented, we will have to look at the resources that are coming in for the grant, and we're told that grant will increase with new regulations from the federal government, and evaluate the policy. We have flexibility to move that. As long as we're reaching that 70% threshold on subsidy and our quality requirements, we can have flexibility to change those education policy rules within our within our program. I think it's always a balance and always an issue of resources and meeting certain goals and benchmarks when there's always competing issues. But it's doable.
Okay, but we don't need to wait for a federal grant for this, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, I guess it's just a word of caution that with the new federal law just being passed and us not having clarity on exactly where they're expecting the grant funds to go, and we know they're increasing at least our quality earmark to 9%, we know that there are certain new strains that will be put on the child care fund that we're getting from the federal government, so we just are going to have to wait for those new rules to come down and have better instruction. But once that occurs, I would say there would be opportunity to change these items.
Senator Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to just point out that there is a growing cultural awareness of this problem. And Utah Valley University, I live down in Spanish Fork, and Utah Valley University has, and some of you maybe, or all of you may be aware, done a remarkable job at addressing this issue at their university. And just, I think it was last year, opened a child care facility right on campus where mothers, particularly single mothers or low income or one income family mothers can go, have access to this. And there are, I don't know all of the details of who gets it for free or limited cost or whatever, but it's very beneficial, and they're trying hard to make really, it's a beautiful facility, it's an amazing facility, and it's right there so moms feel like they have easy access to their children, that they're in a safe environment. Like, they've just really done a great job. So, maybe this is something that a culture throughout the academia that can percolate around the state. I know that they rely heavily on private grants, but maybe we can, if we want to, have them come and tell us about it at some point. But I think I just wanted to give them a little pat on the back because they've done a really good job at addressing this issue so that women can finish their degrees.
I think that's an excellent idea. I also think that the good senator has hit on a potential strategic area for this commission as well, too, and that could be incentives for educational institutions, particularly public education institutions like the universities. What can we do to incent them to develop programs such as this that would be helpful? Ms. Irene.
Well, I just wanted to be sure that I understood where the points of potential policy change are on this chart. The CCDBG is a federal statute. So we have the state policy, the statutory column is federal statute, is that correct?
The statutory column is state statute.
It's state statute. And the administrative rule is a state administrative rule, and DWS policy, of course, is state. So the sorts of the descriptions of provisions with corresponding statute, administrative rule, and EWS policy are actually all open for policy change. Is that correct?
Correct.
Am I interpreting that properly? Okay.
If I could just quickly go back to Senator Henderson's comment about the child care and university settings, and I was actually up at Utah State University yesterday, and they said we've got a great program, we have money for parents that are going back to school, and we want to support them. There are other funding sources for those programs, just so you're aware that not all of it comes through the Office of Child Care. The Federal Department of Education provides funding for those university child care settings, and that's not to say that we couldn't use child care development block grant funds for that as well, but there are this is part of the confusion with all the various funding sources, but there is a separate funding source that's supporting those programs too. So I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention. Just really quickly on the quality side, what do we do with our money? And again, it's about ensuring that low-income children have the opportunities for quality childcare, and this is becoming more and more critical as early childhood development research is coming to the forefront, and we know how important it is, and we know about disparities in school readiness amongst low-income children and their more affluent peers. So making sure that when mom and dad are not able to care for the child in the home because they're working or pursuing an education, that those children are in quality settings. And this is just a list of some examples of what we use our quality money for, and that's in greater detail also in that spreadsheet. Just to reiterate again that we do have a new law that came down. The Child Care Development Block Grant has not been rewritten or reauthorized since 1996. A lot has changed in the world of early childhood development. A lot has changed in policy in 1996. The Block Grant Fund was part of the welfare reform initiative, and the focus was on the parent and getting parents in the workforce. And there has been a little bit of balancing that has occurred in this new reauthorization that balances the needs of getting parents in the labor force, but also continuity of care and focusing on early childhood development at the same time that you're providing the financial support needed for the parents. So there are a lot of changes that are going on in terms of health and safety and licensing inspections and how we spend our quality money and increased transparency for consumer education. Fortunately, Utah has already done a lot of these things, but there will be a lot more coming. And I appreciate your interest in this issue, invite you to stay involved in it as we move forward and try and navigate the changes to the federal policy and get those implemented in our state program.
Okay, we've got another question.
Thank you,
Ms. Barnett.
Thank you, Representative Seedy. Thank you, Tracy, for taking your time to come here. Now, I don't know the policy or the poverty levels and all this stuff that you've given out. This is what I know. If a woman is making $10 an hour, because you say here, employment support child care to families who are income eligible working. So I am a layperson. I don't know that. I know how much you make an hour, what that would be if I were making $10 an hour, which is a stretch because it's not even the minimum wage is $7. So I'm making $10 an hour. I have two children. I need to have a job, so I'm working 20 hours. Now, you're telling me that if I put that together, it's around $10,400 a year. Is that, maybe it's based on how many children you have? Can you just give it to me in wages and children, or is it all based on the scale of the poverty level and you're below this and you're, I'm sorry. And I'm having an anxiety because I'm a little bit uncomfortable even asking the question, but that's in my world, that's how I work, is how much you make an hour, what you bring home, what your expenses. I was a single mom raising two daughters, and that's what I had to look at. And anyone, that's just what I'm looking at. It just, I'm sorry, it's just like, Tracy, you're my friend. Thank you.
Apologize for that question. I think it helps all of us it helps me understand as well too. And to put it within a real life context, Thank you for the question.
I've got my calculator here. You know, plus FICA, taking FICA and federal out, and oh my golly, and I'm thinking, all right, just give me the basics there.
If I wish I could give you the basics.
Okay, I understand.
It is. It is not a silly question. You shouldn't know the answer. I have to acknowledge that it's extremely complicated, and
yes.
It's based on family size, it's based on income, and it's based on that 56% of the state median income. And off the top of my head, I don't know what it is for a family of three. We have charts that lay that all out. I think if you're making $10 an hour and you're working 20 hours a week, and you've got two children at home, you would be income eligible for child care subsidies.
But if I got a raise and made $12 an hour?
Well, as long as you're not reaching, going over that 70% cap that we have in our program, then you would still be able to receive subsidy. As I mentioned earlier, that your co-payment would go up.
Sure.
And it's something that I think we could look at as to how much it goes up, and if you're making $12 an hour, you're still, I think you're still below the poverty level, if I'm not mistaken. You still would get subsidy. I think once you reach that closer to 70%, your co-payments are going to go up. But again, it's based on family size and family income, and I wish I could tell you it's a straightforward formula, but it's not.
Okay, just one more question. My light's off. I put it back on again. Thank you. Just one more question. So back 30 years ago when I was looking for child care, I remember calling on the telephone. We called on the telephone then. I called on the telephone and was inquiring within my community, the Little Sugar Health community, looking for child care. And when I would interview, there were so many children they took from, they called it welfare, and then so many, and I was going to be paying myself. And so what my question is, how much are these child care providers who are taking care of our most precious, precious children, what are they being paid an hour? What are you subsidizing them an hour? $2 an hour, $3 an hour? The child care, can you give me that amount? No.
Again, all of the formulas on the subsidy amounts and the co-payment amounts have varying factors in them. I mentioned the local market rate that we do every 2 years, where we poll providers to find out. This is a requirement of the federal government that we do a market rate survey. We poll providers and we ask them what their market rate is. Market rates vary by setting. So a child care center, a family, friend, and neighbor setting, a licensed family center, they vary by the age of children that they take. So infant toddler care is going to be more expensive than 3- and 4-year-old care. And all of those get factored into how we compensate them for their subsidies.
Thank you, Tracy.
Ms. Byring.
Actually, Ms. Barnett really captured my question was, can we use some of this block grant money to increase the wages that the child care workers are getting paid? Because I would imagine that the majority of them would qualify as being below poverty. And is there some mechanism to provide support for paying the child care workers? And I think that that's the question that you were asking Ms. Barnett too,
yes,
about what they're earning, because they're, and you know, to be honest, the majority of them are women.
Mm-hmm. And many of them are receiving subsidy for their children. That's a great question. I don't believe we can tie funding amounts specifically to wage increases, but I'm not 100% certain on that. What we can do, and what we do, and what we did last session, is increase the subsidy amount to the providers under the theory that if you increase the subsidy amount to providers, that will get passed on
to the actual child care providers. The other thing that we do in our state is we provide professional development incentives for child care providers. So if they progress on the career ladder and get more training and skills to be quality child care providers, we provide monetary incentives to them. Now they're nominal, they're not huge, but we know that after a long day of work caring for children and then asking them to go get professional development and use money out of their own pocket for that professional development on what is known to be a pretty small wage is a challenge, and we do provide, use our professional development quality dollars to provide a little bit of incentive for them, and they have said that that has made a difference for providers progressing on that career ladder because any dollar amount helps. But in terms of tying our grants to wages, I don't have an exact answer for you, but I'm happy to find out.
Thank you, Tracy. Senator Henderson, do you know what they pay the child care workers at UVU? Because you use that as such a great model, I'm wondering if they're paying more competitive wages to their workers to enhance the quality of the service they're providing.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't have an answer to that, but I think inviting Dr. Susan Masson to come speak to the commission and maybe someone else who, I don't know if she knows all of the intimate details about the child care facility, but it would be interesting to note. I did want to make a comment after you're done with your questioning, actually. Okay, thank you. Sorry. If I may, Madam Chair, make an observation.
Lovely. Thank you.
Statement. So in regards to paying the wages, I have some personal knowledge about the difficulty, not firsthand because I have never been a child care worker in a daycare facility, but my sister, who lives in Arizona, so there are different state regulations down there, but she has to abide by all of the federal regulations. My sister owns two large daycare facilities that she built from the ground up. I do not know a more kind-hearted, loving, compassionate, wonderful, giving human being than my sister, to her own detriment most of the time. And I can tell you that she, you know, her goal in life is to make sure that the children within the walls of her facilities are loved and cared for, and that her workers are taken very good care of. The biggest barrier to that for her are regulations. They're outrageous. They're outrageous. Her husband is blind. He stays home and takes care of the children while she works 18 hours a day, stays up most of the night filling out paperwork, trying to comply with. So I caution you, I know there are a lot of regulations that you have no control over. And some of them are good, but some of them are ridiculous. And so I just caution you, from your perspective, you know, you have the power to set some regulation and policy in the state, and you know, I would just encourage you to think about, yes, the health and safety and well-being of the children and the workers and all of that, but also think about the women who are running these facilities and working in them. The costs that are involved in regulations are huge. That is a huge barrier to increasing wages for workers.
Do you have anything else with your presentation?
I do not.
Okay. I have a couple comments. Thank you. I think this is great progression with this based on the count from where we were last time, and I appreciate you taking the time to break this down. This is very helpful. In following up on the observations and inquiries of our commission members, I would like another column that discusses potential solutions and best practices. That would include public solutions, like more money, different or less regulations, I'm using just examples, private sector opportunities. And I'm glad that Senator Henderson for bringing up that example. There's a woman in my neighborhood that actually runs childcare out of her home and does a million other things in addition to that for community service, and her husband works outside of the home, and one of the big barriers for her has been cost of some of the licensing, for example, for fire inspection. She agrees, I agree. I think we can all agree that it's probably a good idea to have a safe home from fire, especially if you have children in there. It's costing her like $300 to $500 every time an inspector has to come out, which is part of the license. And she watches like three children in her home. I mean, it's not, sometimes it costs more for the licensing than it does to actually provide the service. I think that also speaks to efforts going forward related to data collection for this group and what we've talked about related to qualitative and experiential information to actually hear people's real life experiences with this, because I think a lot of times we don't fully understand what it means to live in an infrastructure of limited resources and roles, and so when people have to navigate that, we need to know what that is. Senator Henderson.
Thank you. And just to follow up with that, you know, when you're looking at, when we're looking at help as child care subsidies at, what did you say, they were 60% of fair market value? So, but when a daycare or a child care worker agrees to take that 60% and have subsidized children in their daycare facilities or in their homes, whichever it is, are they subject to more additional regulations on top of the ones they already are to be a licensed child care facility in order to qualify to get those, I guess, the government money, the little bit of government money that comes with the subsidized children?
I think for most of our providers, they have to meet the licensing requirements in order to get the subsidy.
Whether they get the subsidized children or not, it's all the same requirements. There's not additional requirements if they're getting some kind of subsidy.
Correct. I mean, we will not pay subsidy to a provider that isn't licensed unless they're licensed exempt under the state rules, of which there are several that are licensed exempt. For family, friend, and neighbor providers, they don't have to be licensed, but there are new requirements that require them to have health and safety and fire inspection. Under the new federal rules that are coming out, we know that licensed and licensed exempt facilities will have to abide by health and safety standards even under all circumstances and background check provisions, which they were not subject to before. But
for subsidized?
Correct,
or not subsidized.
If subsidy children are going to be in there.
So yeah.
We're using CCDF money.
And so for trying to increase the pool of good quality daycare facilities for children who have parents who need to put them there, we're missing the mark. We're not aligning the right incentives. If it's going to cost people a lot of money to get 60% market value for a child to care for it, why would they do it? It doesn't make any sense to me. So, I think, I know with federal regulations, there's nothing we can do but throw things at the wall and then just comply. But we really need to think about the incentives that we're trying to put out there. If we're trying to have more facilities, more access for people who have subsidized child care needs, we got to align the incentives properly.
And I appreciate that, and I think that we do try to take the regulations that are provided to us from the federal government and not overburden providers while keeping all that safety in mind for the children. And I think it's interesting to talk about whether or not we can provide incentives to offset some of those costs. And I think in some circumstances we are offsetting some of those licensing costs for providers through our child care resource and referral, but it's definitely something that we can talk more about.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I know there's only so much you can do, but I see this as a huge barrier to the problem that we're trying to solve.
So does it make sense, based on the conversation that we've had today, what this needs to look like going forward? Terry, do you have any comments about that? I mean, so the next column is basically, what are some potential solutions related to that? And then the other part is, as Ms. Barnett has brought up a question that I myself had, is that we need a picture. We need a scenario, some scenarios. This is how much this person is making. This is how many children. At what point does their success in a workplace become detrimental because they make too much money? That happened to my mother, actually, as well, too, when I was growing up. She, at one point, turned down a raise because it would end up hurting her. So in that space, in that transitional space, how can we visualize that with a real-world example? And while we're waiting for Dr. Robinson to come back, what can we do now? What can we do? What role can members of the commission take in the area of child care for the coming months, immediately, like next 30 days?
Well, I think the fact that the new federal law has been passed is the perfect opportunity to engage and invite this commission to be involved with familiarizing all of us and determining how we're going to be utilizing our block grant going forward. And I know that in our office, we're going to be having a steering committee to talk about the policy that will have stakeholders in it, including the providers, because they are going to have new rules, and what does that look like for them? And I would just invite anyone who's interested from this commission to participate in those conversations going forward.
Okay, great. So, am I hearing a formal invitation?
Yes,
okay.
Formal invitation. We are not going to have a lot of clarity on this until the end of January, which also presents a challenge for the chart, because going forward, we just don't know at this point. So we will have more clarity at the end of January. This commission, members who want to be involved in that conversation and be part of that steering committee, I welcome you to participate in that and be at the table as we talk about it with other stakeholders, because I feel like this is a really an area for involvement with the new reauthorization.
This is huge. So who on this commission would like to participate in those discussions? Ms. Barnett? Who else? John Lund. Please include me. I find myself volunteering so much, even though I'm going to be out. This is becoming weird. And one more comment related to it's a quick question, because we are 45 minutes behind. Related to educational support, do we also provide support for books or things of that nature? I know that books can cost a whole heck of a lot of money. I know that, for example, when someone's in a certified nursing assistant training, they have to pay for a uniform, they have to pay for a stethoscope, they have to pay for blood pressure devices, and so that's not, so there's tuition, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff. Is the other stuff eligible for assistance or taken into account for the total cost of education for somebody?
I will defer to my colleague, Kathy, to answer that question, because we just provide child care for parents who are pursuing an education.
That's a great question. And I'm just going to state up front, I'm not a TANF expert, but this will fall under the purview of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And if the family is receiving cash assistance under that program, and they also want to do some kind of training education, they can also receive
assistance for books and for uniforms and those kind of items. Absolutely.
Is that up front or afterwards? Is that a reimbursement?
I believe that, no, they can get it up front.
Okay, because if you don't have it, then how should you Okay, you know, it might be really interesting at some point that to put a parking lot issue in is to develop a set of scenarios. Like, I know that there are different games that are out there that people can play, like a day in the life of, to actually see what somebody has to go through to be able to navigate some of this stuff. I think that that could be very, very helpful. All right, thank you all. Thank you, thank you. Dr. Robinson? We have 40 minutes.
Sorry. Jeff's going to help me out here and leave the slides. But because of our time limitations, I think I'm going to move a little bit quicker than I planned in talking about the matrix and what we've done with that. And then we can move into, and then we'll move into the priorities. But you each have in your packet what we're calling a draft report or a memo. It's really a working document. And it's the data that's been presented to us over the last several months, or data that we've collected based on the questions and the conditions we have identified as a commission as being important. Those things that were in the matrix. And I really owe a huge thanks to the staff at the Center for Public Policy. Anna, who's in the room, did a great deal of work. Carrie from DWS and her staff, Natalie as well, have given us a lot of input. And then we've gathered data from the YWCA's report, Susan Madsen from UVU's data, and a number of other sources who've been here over the last few months.
So I really see this as just
a draft memo on those issues that we've identified in the matrix as being important. And you'll see it, we've identified them into a couple of groups. Can you back up a few, Jen? Sorry. Yep. Poverty, education, and that's enrollment, as well as attainment, occupation, labor force participation rates, wage gap, the differences in the field of work, those occupation codes by gender, business leadership and ownership, political leadership. We can keep going. But I know that there are a lot of questions on this matrix that we haven't answered here in this document. And I want to point out that it's because either data doesn't exist or we don't have the resources to go and find that data, collect that data, whether it's qualitative or quantitative. So there may be questions like what cultural barriers exist and their impact, an issue that was brought up in our very first meeting that hinder women's professional development or maybe their educational development. But again, as much of what we've compiled was into this single document. So we're going to start and just do a quick overview based on our time. There's a number of statistics and graphics and figures throughout the document on poverty. This is just one I wanted to point out. It's familiar to us all that a single woman with children in the house, high rate of poverty, 39% in the state of Utah, a little bit higher nationally. And you can see married couple with children, only 8% of that group is in poverty. When we look at the next slide, we can see the importance of education and its relationship to poverty. Female households with children with less than a high school degree, 51% of that group is in poverty. But then you can go to that far right corner. Women, females with children in their home with a bachelor's degree or higher, just 12% of that population is in poverty. So I'm not saying anything new. I'm just really trying to baseline us again on the importance of these issues. And then we talked about education through this. And Anna collected some information. This is, in the state of Utah, the difference between men and women enrollment in our state institutions. It doesn't include Westminster or BYU. You can see the check of men serving their missions in those ages, and then the pop there of men from 22 to about 29 in their high rate of enrollment, women's dropping. It could be that they're reaching their degrees, or it could be that they're pulling out of of the state institutions just to take care of their families, those kinds of things. We don't really know. But we also have some good data throughout this document that I'm not going to share with you. You can look at it by institution. We do include BYU in there, and can back up a little bit, Jim. Thanks. Thanks. Hold there. And Westminster in there, and then we have some information about attainment as well. This is one that I really want to point out to you. We've talked a lot about whether women are losing their edge in this state, but this is women ages 25 years older and men 25 years older, and we compare the U.S. numbers with the Utah numbers. You can see bachelor's degrees were pretty much on par, women and men in this state. Where we lose that advantage is when we're looking at graduate degrees. So about 8% of women have a graduate degree in the state compared to about 13% of men. When we compare women in the state with women nationally, we're seeing an 8 to about 11% attainment. It's something just to pay attention to. And then on this next slide again, going back to whether we're losing our edge, Carrie and I had this discussion last week. Women are on the right trajectory here, okay? Just so you know, we are moving in a positive direction in the state. We're moving in a positive direction nationally. What's changed slightly here, and it really is just a slight change, more women in the state used to have bachelor's degrees than at the national level. It's just shifted a little bit, but it's a minor shift. We're looking at 28% to 29%. This is bachelor's degrees, but it's the graduate degrees to really start paying attention to where that shift is and that gap has grown. Field of study, this is a major concern to us. Men and women are graduating in different degrees, and we have some really solid data in your packet that outlines the field of study bachelor degree areas. Men are dominating the STEM fields. They're dominating business, engineering, mathematics, those fields, and women are concentrating heavily in fields like education, family, consumer sciences, the performing arts. The only exception to the STEM field is where we put health, the healthcare. And women are very active in studying in the field of healthcare. But they tend to be in like things like nursing, nurse practitioners, those kinds of things. And I'm glad to take a question if we have one too, Senator.
That was my question. What are they,
the
high-paying, you know?
Yeah. They are. And so if you look, when we get to the next section, we're going to talk about occupation. You can see, we'll hit on this labor force participation, but in the next section, we're going to talk about occupation and the real disparity between where men and women are working and their pay in those fields. I'm going to hit first here on labor force participation because what you see is a really significant drop for Utah women when they hit this age of childbearing age. And it's not as significant of a drop nationally. Yeah,
before you go, I just have one question on the STEM. Because women are so underrepresented in those areas, do you see that their wages are actually higher in STEM fields?
Okay. No. So we'll go to the next one, we can show you. This is just occupational status. Couple things, women in Utah are much less likely to work full-time. We know that's not surprising to us. Just a couple data points. You guys can take a look at this more intently later, but I want to get to Heather's question, and it's really this next slide, Heather. So we just popped a few of these occupation fields. This is from DWS data. You have the full list of occupation fields in your report, but this is where it's important because you can see certain fields are dominated by men, but also you can see the real significant pay differences between men and women in those fields. A word of caution, something like the occupation field of legal includes not just attorneys, but it can include paralegals or legal secretaries. That can account for some of that wage gap difference. But it doesn't account for it all, as Carrie talked about a couple meetings ago. This is one of those things, leadership in both business and in government sector, that's really near and dear to my heart. And the presentation we had earlier, she hit on a lot of these points, but I'm just going to reiterate it, and you have more details in the document that we gave you.
these are Utah statistics, 82% of the executives in our state are male, just 18% are female. Average pay for female executives is around $81,000, but for men it's $137,000. Huge gap difference. And among the top 45 companies in our state, only 8% of the board seats are held by women. Ownership, there's a huge difference here. These are large firms, which means 50 or more employees. 4% of large firms in our state are owned by women. 44% are owned by men. Half are publicly held. And then just a few more data points for you to take home. 79% of all businesses in our state have fewer than 10 employees, and 84% of female-owned businesses have fewer employees. They're self-proprietorships, maybe handfuls of employees. Large firms with 50 or more employees, most of them are owned by men. We said that earlier. And both in Utah and nationally, female-owned firms account for less than 4% of overall sales and receipts in our country. Political leadership, this one, we've dived down. You saw some information in the YWCA's report, and you've seen things out of Susan Matson's report. We are going to dive down beyond elected positions because I think it's critically important we pay attention to those executive leaders as well. So Congress, this is current Congress, 19% female. Cabinet positions, 27% female, 73% male. In our state, all of our executive branch positions are held by males. In our cabinet, 32% are females and 68% are males. This is agriculture, health department, administrative services, all of those things. You guys know this in the room, 16% of our legislators are women. And then, important, we need to go down to the local level as well. This is for our county commissions and councils. We have 29 counties in our state. 87% of those commission seats and council seats are held by men. In 17 of our 29 counties, there is not one single woman serving on the council or the commission. And in 10 of them, they just have one woman serving. It's important stuff to be paying attention to. 29 counties, there's a lot of parity for a number of positions, the clerk, the treasurer, the assessor, the auditor, the reporter, but again, county commissioner numbers are really low for women. There's not a single woman sheriff or a single woman DA right now in the state. Does it get better for our cities and our towns? We have 244 mayors, 18 of them are women in our state. Of the largest cities, the 50 most populous, only 4 have female mayors. And all of our cities with populations of 30,000 people or more, they all have male mayors. There's not one female. Councils aren't a whole lot better. Just 23% of our council members are female, 77% are male. And a third of our city councils in Utah are all
dominated.
Okay. School boards, I think, is our next section. A lot of evenness here for the state, but when we get down to the local school board level, that's when we see another gap. School board presidents, 71% of our school board presidents are male. 93% of our superintendents in the state are male. Yeah, it's a little surprising. As I said before, this is really a compilation of all the work that this commission has done to put together that matrix, and you identified a number of questions, and we've gathered that through the committee meetings or through the work that Carrie's office and my office has done, and I really view this as a working document. It leaves a number of questions on that matrix that are unanswered, and I just listed those here. You can take a look. But Madam Co-Chair, I think this really leads us into the next agenda item, and that is talking about the priorities for this commission and how we go forward.
I would agree. I have a couple questions about the research quickly. I don't think that we have the answers to those right now.
Yeah.
If anyone else has any pressing questions, then ask them, because this is, you can't get the data unless we ask for it.
And for the first time in a long time, and Lori Chillingworth had on this too, is that we're showing an interest in asking the questions. We don't know because people haven't asked. So, do we know, some of my colleagues have asserted that CEOs, female CEOs, don't earn as much by far by male CEOs because they have children and take time off. Do we know, related to wages, about family status of any of those people, or is that a question that we'll continue? Can we ask that and break that down?
Sure.
So I have my staff looking into that right now, and what we hope to accomplish, Natalie's here, she's the one that will be working on that. What we hope to accomplish is to get at that data and then also to build a model that really measures the wage gap while all of these things are simultaneously being controlled for. So we control for occupational choice, tenure in the occupation, entry and exit into the labor force, age, age, race, etc., and then really estimate the wage gap when all of those things are considered simultaneously. We truly have a comparison of an equivalent male and female and their wages being compared.
Ms.
Thompson? Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick comment about the compensation for CEOs, and a portion of them are business owners where they choose their own salary. So there are some that are, the salaries are offered to them, and then those, the other portion, actually choose their own, and it is lower than their male counterparts of their own accord. So.
Dr. Robinson,
I guess what I would ask the commission is your support that we continue to add to this, that this remains a working document for the commission. One of the requirements in our legislation that established us is that we need to provide an annual report. And I think this could be the basis for an annual report that gives a status update to the governor and legislators and others in our community on where women stand in our state as related to the economy. And as we move forward, that we just continue to add information to this and explore those questions that are in the matrix.
Ms. Barnum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When is the annual report stated to be issued in the legislation? The reason I ask is that may also be a good opportunity from a communication standpoint to do some media around it or some communication outreach with it. So about what is the timing that's dictated in that?
It's unclear to me whether it's July when the commission would have their first year, or would it be next December? I'm not clear in the legislation.
It's not clear in the legislation. That was an opportunity for enhancement that I could have had with it. There was a mini annual report given as part of what the Division of Workforce Services is required by statute to provide their legislative committee every year. This came after, I think, our second meeting. So the speaker and I attended and said, we're working really hard and this is what we've done. But I agree with you related to the communications. And I think that we can decide. So it makes sense, I believe, to have it at the onset of our 1 year anniversary. Senator Henderson, do you have any thoughts on that? No? Okay. A couple thoughts related. I think I would say yes to your question as far as I'm concerned. Living document needs to continue. We need to hit on some of the qualitative data and real life experiences of people. Again, I was with the Women in Water, the engineering group of women yesterday, and people kept coming up afterwards and said, we want an opportunity to talk about our experience in this and with STEM in particular. All the focus is on getting degrees, but not on being sustainable afterwards in work environments. And they felt like nobody was listening. So, I mean, there's that component of it. And then also, again, what Ms. Burnett hit on is that this stuff, the presentation is excellent.
we also need to communicate to people in a way with the real life scenario that people can enhance an understanding of things. This is Ms. Burkholder. Sorry, Barbara.
That's okay. Thank you. There are a lot of bees on an archery.
Thank you. I just thought that might be a good opportunity for me to also mention that I'm part of Women in in Transportation as well, and they approached me when they heard that I was going to be part of this commission and said, we have all sorts of research and we're really wanting to be engaged in what you're doing from the STEM perspective and specific to careers in transportation, which would be more in the engineering sense. And so they really wanted the opportunity to either come in and talk to us and present some of that research or work with our research team. So I wanted to mention that, and I thought that might be a good opportunity.
Great. Okay, thank you. Ms. Barnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Seeley. I love this document, and I'm not intimidated by it. I totally understand it. What I do understand is the 7.9% graduate. And as I look across the table with Ann Burkholder, realizing that my daughter was working at the YWCA and also getting her graduate, her MPA, and that was many, many years ago, and to this day, we are so very grateful that she has that. That being said, I also know from my own work experience that women are the worst negotiators. Yes, there are a lot of men out there, and we feel like we're asking our male fathers or our parent for a raise, and mostly that is the males, and I have to say I'm probably to blame as well. So that, I think, has something to do with perhaps not getting what we really want because we're intimidated sitting across. One last thing. I have, as well as many of you, been on many search committees for principals and administrators and et cetera, and gone on many or been part of an interview process. And I have to tell you that I know that women are not confident in asking for the position that they know they deserve. And we also need to work on reaching out to them as well. I mean, or giving the message. Like Jennifer Seelig said, we just need to have a scenario of the life in the life of one day of trying to reach the goals that you want to reach. So thank you so much. I really love this document. I'm angry, but I love it. Thank you.
Okay.
Ms.
Robinson, there's that stat that is hovering around in many conversations about the gap of women completing their undergraduate degree is the largest in the country. Is that captured someplace here? Because I think that's an important...
You talk to this for national. We'll have to check on that. Yeah.
Okay. We'll
make sure it gets included.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay.
Yes, very quickly, a question about the choice of sectors to look at and whether we should be including the third social sector as well. You're looking at government and public service, both elected, appointed, and career. You're looking at businesses, and the third sector in our society is the social sector, which includes many nonprofits of very different stripes. So I know Dr. Madsen has done some recent research on that, and it's an important sector, and it's particularly important for women, I think.
Yes.
So I would encourage the researchers working on this to include that as a breakdown in some of your analysis.
We are glad to do that. Thank you. Dr. Robinson, please continue. Okay. So we're really going to move on to that next agenda item, which is focusing on some priorities for the upcoming year.
I put up here on the slide the legislative purpose. These are the three things that we have been established to do. Increase our understanding of the impact and needs of women and how it can be met. Identify and recommend policies, procedures, programs to best respond to the rights and the needs and the impact of women as related to the economy. And facilitate coordination of the functions of private and public entities concerned with women in the economy. So along those lines, the co-chairs, Carrie and I, have had some discussions about establishing a set of priorities for the upcoming year. And goes back to the slide. We are going to be very bold and list three things that we can focus on this year. This list could be expanded upon, but I think it captures a lot of what we have talked about in the last several months. The first would be increasing the awareness of the status of women in Utah's economy. This would include that communication component that is so critical, and it goes back to our legislative purpose. The second priority would be conduct additional research to understand the needs and the status of women as it relates to the economy. This goes back to all those unanswered questions in that matrix that we haven't been able to get to, and could include establishing a subcommittee that does research. And the third one is influence public policy. Talking about DWS today and our worries about statutes or administrative rules or policies that are internal to an organization, it makes me think that this is really important, that we have an impact beyond just creating an understanding of the status of women, but advocate for changes in policies that advance the position of women in our economy. So, Jen, I'm going to hand the mic over to you and just let you lead the discussion.
I'm going to take the mic from you. Thank you for putting all of that together. So based on these strategic priorities, I just wanted to do a check-in with people to make sure that you're okay with the way that we have framed this.
Go back to the prior slide.
Our demographics, projected demographics included in this. We've had presentations about that. I didn't see any of the data today, but I actually think that's a very important part of what we do, is projecting out what we're seeing in terms of women, in terms of women of color, etc. So I didn't know whether you incorporated that in your status.
I would agree with you that in my conceptualization of this, that yes, that is a very important part of our research.
We include that data in the modeling, so it will be accounted for as we work through this. So we agree that the importance of acknowledging that the demographics and needs are shifting, we can't assess the future otherwise, so we will definitely.
But when I bring this subcommittee to formally articulate the creation and existence of those subcommittees, they will fall in line with the three strategic priorities, and I will make sure that the words related to demographics are included in the research. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Barnum?
Our third goal of facilitating that collaboration with existing entities that are also in pursuit of the same goal, I'm not sure that I'm seeing where that one falls, other than maybe
under number three, but it seems like there's a lot of opportunities to piggyback on what's already being done, and that's a lot of what we do in these meetings, is we bring them in and say, how can we work together? So I wouldn't want to lose that collaboration.
If I may.
That's where I was.
I agree with you. And so when we create these priorities and we agree to them, then we can create subcommittees for those. The subcommittees over the next few months could work on objectives, and one objective might be creating partnerships or liaisons with other organizations in the community, the Salt Lake Chamber's women's work, or UBU and Susan Madison's work, those kinds of things. That could fall under priority number one, the partnerships and increasing awareness.
Okay. Yeah, I just need to be able to see it linearly.
Yes, I do too.
That's how I put the planning, right?
I am waiting.
Okay, great. Thanks.
I think that's an excellent point, and it makes sense to put under that heading. And I'll make sure that that's formally articulated. Okay. Senator Henderson.
Sorry, taking a lot more than my fair share today. But my only hesitation is with the word status. Is that our priority to make people aware of the status of women in our economy, or to make them aware of the importance of women in our economy?
I think it, in my mind, it would be both. So it's where we are and where we need to be.
Well, or what, you know. Yes, I that's, and that's my question, and I'm not saying we should change it, but to me it looks like we're just wanting to tell people kind of what the newspaper articles have been telling people.
I totally
And I think that we should prioritize increasing awareness of why women's involvement in Utah's economy is important.
But awareness is stature.
I quickly just pulled out the legislative information about the commission in the first place, and it doesn't actually say status in here. It says increase public and government understanding of the current and future impact of the needs of the state's women in the economy, and how these needs may be more effectively and efficiently met. So maybe it is, I mean, it's this terminology, I guess, but it would be the current impact and the future impact.
That
yeah.
Okay.
Could we change it so it's something like increased awareness of the needs and the impact of women in each other's economy?
So, please articulate the sentence as you would like it to read.
Can you read that?
Sure.
It's on the top of this, goal number one.
Okay.
Increase public and government understanding of the current and future impact and needs of the state's women in the economy, and how those needs may be most effectively and efficiently met.
Excellent observation. Let's make that strategic priority number one, with the understanding that this is a living document, and as we evolve and come up with new ideas, this is more than welcome to enhance. So thank you. I appreciate that because, yeah, thank you. Okay, with that change, are we all in favor of having those three strategic priorities? Does someone like to make a motion?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so. In aligning our subcommittees with these priorities, we already established, I believe, the last meeting or the meeting before, the communications subcommittee. Their strategic priority will be, as we articulated just now in our motion, volunteers from the prior meeting were Speaker Lockhart, myself, Ms. Barnum, and Ms. Thompson. Is anyone else interested in being on that subcommittee? Now, the charge of that would include the partnership and examining the strategic partnerships that we have with other organizations, like the Women's Leadership Council, maybe Real Women Run, or whatever other groups that we can coordinate with to make sure that we're making the most effective and efficient use of our time and resources in there. Is anyone else interested? Okay, fabulous. Let the record note that desiring is also
Let the record show that Ms. Irving is also part of that subcommittee. So, does everyone agree with the parameters of that subcommittee? Would someone like to make a motion?
I have a question on that one. Thank you so much. The question that I have is, would there be a benefit, because there's so much involved with the collaboration and the partnerships and finding those synergies and opportunities with the varying organizations, if that actually were its own subcommittee? I don't want to over-subcommittee this commission, but they could actually be charged with that specific task to bring to the communications team, who will already be pretty busy just putting that plan together and executing a lot of the awareness strategies and media strategies and things that we can really do to push some of this awareness out publicly and with key stakeholders. I'm wondering if they could actually be a separate subcommittee.
I actually think that should, I'm glad that you brought up that issue. I actually think that should be still a component of that subcommittee, but we'll
have someone responsible.
Exactly. Right. And as a matter of fact, since we're talking about it right now, maybe we could have a volunteer. I don't know, maybe Ms. Irene would like to do that, particularly since one of the big liaison responsibilities that we're going to have is with the Women's Leadership Council, which it sounds like you're already communicating with. And I mean, is that fair?
Yes.
Turn on your mic. Okay.
So yes, it's fair, and I'm happy to do it. In fact, I would like to raise my hand to be the liaison with that group if they invite me to, or would like me to do that, because I'm, you know, connected from a work perspective there too.
That sounds great. So we just accomplished both. All in favor of that?
Aye.
So Senator Henderson has to leave. Would you like to volunteer for either the research subcommittee or the public policy subcommittee?
Probably public policy.
Fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Good to see you.
I won't make a motion.
Okay, I'll add you formally later, but only to that, I promise, maybe. Okay, Subcommittee 2, research. Conduct additional research to better understand women's status and current and future impact and needs in the economy. This would also include demographics, okay? Who would like to volunteer for the research committee?
Jen, I'd like to volunteer.
Thank you, Dr. Robinson. Ms. Main?
I'll volunteer as well, please.
Fabulous. I love it when people volunteer. Ms. Barnett, would you like to volunteer?
I don't even know where I don't even have, is there a paper on all these committees? Or
no,
it's
just.
Oh, right. So your second list is research, which would include your observations about real life experience and things
that happen. Where are we now? I'm sorry.
We're on research.
We're on research.
Okay, see strategic priority number two.
Okay.
So we're forming a subcommittee to do research or to inform people who are doing research. Okay, so what we're trying to do is gather information about the experiences of women and the status of women
in the state, and there's going to be a group of people, including Dr. Robinson and Carrie Main, who are actually going to be running numbers and doing things like that. Would you like to be part of that committee so that you could talk to them about, like, the questions that you had related to, well, what's it like for a person making $10 an hour with two kids? What does that look like?
Say
yes. Yes, just say yes.
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. Thank you for volunteering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
If I could. So what I'd like to do with that subcommittee is that over the next couple of months we get together, we have some discussions, and we set out a research agenda, and come back to the full committee with a research plan.
Okay.
That we'd like to accomplish.
Are you volunteering to be the chair of that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. That's fabulous, Dr. Robinson. Also, it reminded me that we had not selected a chair for the communications committee. Ms. Barnum,
yeah.
Was your light on? I'm not seeing. Is that?
I think it never was turned off.
Oh.
It's advantageous because I'd be happy to volunteer to chair that committee.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for volunteering.
Okay. Have a slight passion for
Ms. Burkholder.
Yes, I'd like to volunteer for the research committee as well.
Great, thank you.
Of our interest in research about women.
I think that's fabulous. Thank you for your service. Okay, so we're good with those two committees. Third committee, public policy. Influencing it. Who would like to volunteer for this, aside from me and the speaker? Oh, and the senator. Thank you for the doctor. So that would be Senator Henderson, Speaker Lockhart, Representative Steele.
I will volunteer.
Dr. Robinson. Anyone else? Anyone else care about impacting public policy?
I care about that.
When you know what we're doing, the rest of us will help.
I'll volunteer myself to chair that one. Can someone make a motion? Could we agree with that?
I make a motion to agree with that.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Ms. Barnum, did you have a comment?
I'm going to make your motion.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next step. We have, I think that we need to try to have a meeting before the start of the legislative session. So we'll ask Gail to get on that immediately, if you can, to send out a survey or whatever that is, please. And hopefully, between now and whenever that meeting is, the subcommittees can get together once to develop objectives, create action plans, and identify success matrices, or at least begin to do that. And then the subcommittee chairs, did I really volunteer for this? Will be prepared to present the plans at the next meeting. We'll talk about that, okay? The other things that will need to happen at the next meeting is that you all will need to choose a new set of co-chairs. I am not sure who Speaker Lockhart will be appointing to fill her role on this commission. I will be appointing Representative Chavez House, who's in the back. Would you like to raise your hand again? Who is very energetically and enthusiastically going to serve on this committee. Yes. I'll be staffing her, I'm sure.
Do you... do you care if I just make a comment? I was asked from the last 7 minutes of the meeting that I was present for to find out about the rules around subcommittees and public meetings, and I was told that, yes, our subcommittees do need to follow the rules around public meetings. So you will need to, I think we can coordinate with the chairs to help you understand what that entails.
So, Ms. Main, could you get that information out to the chairs as soon as possible?
Yes.
Thank you. Do we have any other items of business top of mind before we adjourn? And the winner is?
Madam Chair, do you need a motion to adjourn?
No, I need to be able to turn on Ms. Barnum's mic.
Really quick, when Carrie, when you send that out, would you also just also bullet the outline of what the subcommittees, how they're structured, and I know we can bring some other people from the community, and you know, just letting the chairs know what some of those elements are too. I've seen it in the legislation, but it would be helpful to have it.
Yep,
absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. And to that, and also in offering that great suggestion, is please include the volunteers on each of those, or willing and energetic volunteers on each of those subcommittees, as well as their contact information, so that our chairs can have it all in one place. Would anyone else like to make another motion?
I'll move that we adjourn.
Ding, ding, ding. All in favor? Or second? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you all for your time.